Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking financial independence at 27 with passive income with Rachel Richards.
Since yesterday was the 4th of July, we wanted to talk about financial independence with someone who has achieved it, and she did so at the young age of 27. Rachel Richards is a former financial advisor. She's a real estate investor with almost 40 rental units, and she's the best-selling author of Money Honey. She also has written Passive Income, Aggressive Retirement, which we'll be covering today as we discuss the lessons that Rachel has learned on her way to financial independence. Rachel has quit her 9-to-5 job, and she now lives off of over $15,000 a month in passive income. And she spends her time now just doing whatever she feels like, whether that's traveling the world with her husband, hiking the Rockies with her dog, or even talking to two money nerds here in Atlanta. So Rachel, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Yes, thank you guys both so much for having me. I'm excited.
We're excited too, Rachel. This is going to be a lot of fun. And our first question to everybody who comes on the show, Matt and I, as all of our listeners know, we really like beer, craft beer in particular. And so it's something that we splurge on now. We buy more expensive beers because that's something we really enjoy while we're trying to save and invest well for our future. So yeah, we want to know from you, what's your craft beer equivalent?
My craft beer equivalent is definitely outdoor gear and hiking gear.
Ooh.
And ski passes. Yeah, especially when we lived in Colorado, REI was like my vice. So we spent a lot of money. Now, I would say I justified it because a lot of the equipment we bought was for safety reasons. So that's my justification for buying what we bought.
You're talking like bear spray, or what are you talking about? Safety?
Yeah, bear spray, satellite communicator for when we're going on hikes.
Oh, I was just joking, but you're serious.
You're like getting remote out there in the wilderness.
Yeah, and the Colorado Rockies. Yeah, you got to have all that stuff.
Oh, that is awesome. That's true. I feel like I could see myself going that direction. The REI annual membership, totally worth it. Have you ever gotten anything from Backcountry as well? I feel like they're one of these new online retailers that have, like, they're making their own stuff, sort of like REI does. But
That's cool. No, I haven't yet, but I'm about to go on a rafting trip, and I have to get more stuff for that. I say I have to, and I'm laughing because I probably don't, but I will.
Nice. Well, yeah, check them out. But we wanted to talk about your story, Rachel. You know, you retired at 27, and so you must have inherited a ton of money, right? we know you didn't. But when did you start to get interested in making, more money? And how did you get interested in investing?
Yeah, it really started at a pretty young age. I grew up in a very wealthy county in elementary, middle, high school. And so my family was definitely not living in poverty or like poor by any means, but I always felt that way just compared to the people that went to my middle school and high school. Cool. So for example, a lot of the kids in my high school got brand new BMWs when they turned 16. My family was, we were not operating that way. I mean, we weren't going out to eat at restaurants, let alone going on a family trip or driving a new car. So I felt like I didn't fit in at a young age, and that's not the way you want to feel in middle school and in high school. And I remember thinking to myself at a pretty young age that I didn't want to end up like everyone else struggling with money. I didn't want to have to operate on a strict budget or borrow money from family and friends to make it to my next paycheck. I wanted to be different. And I realized that what I did then could either set me up for wealth or for poverty. So I became very interested at a young age in financial independence, learning everything I could about money management and investing in the stock market. And I first read Rich Dad, Poor Dad in high school. That was my initial introduction to real estate investing. And I knew right then that that was going to be my path to financial independence.
I got to say, what happens sometimes in those early years has just this major impact on like the course of our life. I think a lot of us can look back and we can say, actually, when I was in middle school, that was the big impact on how I view money and how I operate with money today. So it's interesting to hear kind of that backstory. And hustle also too, Rachel, is this big part of your story. Didn't you get through college without taking on any debt by like a door-to-door selling knives, something like that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I had a lot of fear. So growing up, I had these limiting beliefs. Money is a stressor. There's never enough money. And therefore, I had a lot of fears about not having enough money. And they say fear can either paralyze you or motivate you. Luckily for me, it was a huge motivator. So when I graduated from high school, I was scared about going to college and taking out all these student loans because I knew how crippling it could be for people. So I went to this interview for Cutco Cutlery, and I was so intrigued because this is the first time I'd been exposed to something where the harder you work, the more money you make. And I knew one thing for sure, which is that I could outwork anybody. So I sold Cutco. My mom was less than thrilled about me selling sharp objects to our family and friends. But regardless, I sold Cutco and I paid my way through school and I graduated at age 20, totally debt free.
That is awesome.
What did you learn, by the way, doing that? Because, I mean, you have to learn like some sales technique. There's just a lot involved in being, you know, in selling something like that. And also, too, did you like ruin any friendships or like, you know, upset any family members along the way? Because sometimes you got to get a little pushy if you're going to do well at that.
I know. Not that I know, but I'm sure people were annoyed with me at the time.
But they're like, thankfully, she's moved on from that.
Yeah. What's interesting is that I think I learned more selling Cutco than I did getting my financial economics degree. It's something that has provided me skills that I even use today. So, you know, things like selling and overcoming rejection and how to close and how to ask for things confidently and even things like public speaking and presentation skills, because I went through their management training. So I learned all these other skills that are much needed in the real world. So it's definitely one of the most valuable experiences I've ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. Hustling, making more money, that's a big part of doing smart things with your money, but spending less is also kind of the other side of the equation, right? And here on the show, we actually have this recurring segment that we call Frugal or Cheap. And there's a fine balance between the two, right? Between being cheap, but, you know, trying to be frugal. And so have your attempts at frugality ever crossed that line of frugality and where you've kind of ventured into those cheap waters?
Cheapskate territory.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm glad you guys asked because I talk about this all the time.
Oh, do you? Okay, awesome.
Yes. There's a difference between being cheap and being frugal. And I think that anything when taken to an extreme can be unhealthy or can have negative consequences, right? Spending too much is most people's problem when it comes to money. That has unfortunate consequences. But also being too frugal can end up costing you more money in the long run. And one example of this, I know we're going to talk about real estate investing later, but when we first went to hire our property managers, we decided to go the cheap route. So instead of hiring a professional property management company, we hired this couple that had been working for us, cleaning, doing maintenance. They were always working really hard and always went above and beyond. So we thought, well, why don't we hire them as employees and we'll teach them how to manage our properties? So we did that and it started off great. But about 6 months into the fact, my husband went to collect rent from our on-site log boxes one weekend, and he realized there was a lot of rent missing. And this was not just the normal tenant paying late. It was a significant chunk. So we found out that they had stolen $6,000 in rent income that month.
Wow.
And they'd been squatting in vacant rooms and units in our buildings for almost a year. So that was awful at the time. We can laugh about it now, but it was awful. It was a huge eye-opener for us. And the moral of the story is there are certain places that you just, you don't be cheap there. If we had hired a qualified, bonded, licensed professional property management company and one of their employees did that to us, they would have been liable for the damages, not us. So I feel like, you guys, this is a lesson I've had to learn over and over again because my tendency is to be frugal. So I'm always thinking, okay, wait a second. Is this really the best choice long run to go this route? Or should I spend a little bit more on the higher quality person?
I feel like in the beginning too of real estate investing, you have to make more of those choices because really to make the numbers work and to kind of learn the ropes, you want to do some DIY stuff and you have to cut some of those corners in order to save up the money to buy that next rental property to get to kind of critical mass. And so it can be tough to make those decisions. I was like literally just talking to someone the other day and recounting a story of hiring my own roofer and to put on a roof. And he was like, this guy's an architect and a general contractor. And he was like, man, nobody does it that cheap. The only reason he did it that cheap is because he's not insured. And I'm like, oh, good point. Like, that could have really come back to bite me hiring someone. He did a great job. Fortunately, everything worked out. But things don't always work out. And yeah, so that's definitely good to point out. And it's tough to know that line sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a hard balance. I think sometimes you only even recognize it in hindsight. So it's tough, but I think the more that you learn about yourself and kind of maybe the past mistakes you made with being too cheap, the better you'll be going forward.
That's true. Yeah. So we're talking about being frugal, Rachel. You also make a case for being more frugal with your time, with our time. Can you explain to our listeners what you mean by that? What does it mean to be frugal with your time?
Yes, absolutely. I like to talk about being frugal with all of your resources. Oftentimes we're focused on being frugal with only our money, but at what cost in terms of our time? So for example, there's a lot of people that will drive miles out of their way to save a few cents per gallon on gas. But if that means you're spending an extra 20 or 30 or 40 minutes in the car driving, where you could have used that time investing into something else that's making you more money, is it really the best decision? And I'm not saying there's a right or wrong, but I think we always need to think about our use of time as well. Everything is a time versus money trade-off. And I think when you're starting off in your financial independence journey, you value money more, which makes sense. No pun intended. So you'll spend more time trying to make more money. And then later on, I've gotten to the point now where time is definitely my most valuable resource. So I would rather make less money if it means that I can still have more time to myself.
Yeah, there are definitely things I would have done at 27 myself that at 37 I'm unwilling to take on myself. And Rachel, speaking of time, you know, money and time are the two necessary investments, right, in order to be able to create passive streams of income. And you wrote about this in your book, Passive Income, Aggressive Retirement. So I guess I want to know, what's your definition of passive income? Because I feel like sometimes that term gets thrown around quite a bit, and it gives people false hopes. Sometimes passive income seems like it's this silver bullet and it's going to fix everyone's problems. Cool, let me just get that passive income. So yeah, what's your take on it and how do you define it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because it's definitely a buzzword now, and I do think it's misused a lot. My definition of passive income is that it's money that is earned with little to no ongoing effort. Is it a get-rich-quick scheme? No, absolutely not. It definitely takes time or money to create passive income. The epiphany I had a few years ago is that once your passive income exceeds your living expenses, you're retired, you're financially independent. And I thought it sounded a lot easier to come up with $5,000 or $6,000 or $8,000 a month in passive income than it did to try to work my whole life and accumulate a nest egg of $1 or $2 million by age 65 to retire. So I do think from that sense, creating passive income is a more attainable way to achieve early retirement.
Yeah, it's just like a different way of thinking about the problem. And in your book too, you know, you're talking about how it's not a get rich scheme, right? It's not something that's going to happen overnight. And I love how you kind of break down building these forms of passive income into these two different stages, right? And so you know, you're saying that it does take work, and that stage one is all about building these streams of income, as opposed to stage two, which is just maintaining. And like you said, when you're maintaining things, that requires much less work. But you're not discounting the amount of work that goes into that stage one, right?
Right, definitely not. So think about J.K. Rowling, for example, writing the Harry Potter books.
Love it.
She spent years, yeah, decades writing with no income, no recognition, nothing. And so she spent all of this time in stage one towards building a passive income stream. Then when she finally published the books, they finally started to gain traction and take off. That's when she entered stage two, where all the writing was done. Now she's just basically making income on an ongoing basis. She's doing some marketing appearances and book tours, minimal effort to create an enormous income stream.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to go write a best-selling children's novel after this interview.
But then yeah, it's that easy, right? Everyone can do it.
And then plus all the additional time, you have to be on set at Warner Brothers as they're making sure that they're doing things correctly, because you haven't released the seventh book yet.
Right, and
you know, all the details have to fit.
True, true. And, hey, Rachel, someone in your book, too, that you interviewed, you said the alternative to pursuing passive income is a 9-to-5. And they said, and guess what? That's not passive income at any stage of the game. And I thought that was like so insightful too, right? Because, you know, I think passive income is something worth striving for. But at the same time, there's a lot of people on the internet who are like, just get the passive income. It's easy. And it's not easy, like you just said. But the only other alternative is working 9-to-5 or longer for a lot of people for that income every single week for, you know, 40 years. And I think there is a better way. And I love kind of how you talk about it in your book.
Right. And I'll add to that. A lot of people ask, well, is passive income really passive? And I would say mostly there's not such a thing as true passive income unless you have enough money to invest in the stock market where you're earning dividend income. But the problem with that is that requires an enormous amount of capital to generate meaningful revenue. All of the other passive income streams that I talk about, though, maybe they require a couple hours a week or a few hours a month, but that's still way more passive than a 9-to-5 job.
That's right. Yeah. So that's the amount of time that goes into these passive streams of income is definitely a way for you to consider sources of passive income out there. So after the break, we're actually going to talk about some of the different categories of passive income, as well as a way to gauge how successful these things are going to be. And so we'll get to all of that right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with Rachel Richards about financial independence because it's July 4th week. Why not? And Rachel, before we dive into the different types of passive income that you detail in your book, you talk about a bunch and a lot that probably a lot of our listeners haven't even thought about. You present a really helpful method to evaluate the pros and the cons of choosing between different forms of passive income. They're not all created equal. So yeah, for you, what's the filter that you like to run opportunities through in order to gauge like how potentially effective they're going to be?
Yeah. So the filter that I used is an acronym that I came up with called SCRIMP. S-C-R-I-M-P. So SCRIMP. So it stands for a few different things. I'm just going to go letter by letter. But you start with looking at S, which is for scalability. You want to think to yourself, how scalable is this? For example, if you're trying to teach a in-person cooking class, then you might only have room for 20 people wherever you're cooking. However, if you decide to take that cooking class online and teach it online instead, then it's virtually unlimited how many people can attend. So simply by taking something online, you're making it very scalable. So that's the first thing to think about in terms of how successful it could potentially be. The second thing is control and regulation. So that's the CR, is control and regulation. You want to think about how much control do you actually have over this passive income stream. For example, if you're selling digital products or digital downloads on Etsy, they can shut you down at any time. If you violate their terms and conditions, or they don't like something that you've put up, or you violate a copyright or trademark, they can completely shut down your account. And if you've spent years building that up and you're making $3,000 or $5,000 or $7,000 a month, that can go away in the blink of an eye. So you don't you still have some control there, but you don't have ultimate control. And the more control you have, the better.
And that's one of the downsides too of operating within some of these different platforms or some of these different apps is that you're beholden to whatever they decide to do with the company.
Exactly. And unfortunately, it's hard to completely get away from that. I mean, even a lot of my income streams are dependent on other platforms. But as long as you have that in mind and you can think about how can I have greater control, that's the ideal scenario. The third thing you'll want to think about is I, which is for investment. So we already talked a little bit about the fact that creating passive income does require some upfront work, normally in the form of time versus money. So one thing you want to ask yourself starting out is, do I have more time or money to invest into creating my passive income stream? Now, if you're anything like I was a few years ago, you would say, well, I have neither. I don't have time and I don't have money. So the next thing to ask yourself, well, which is going to be easier for you to free up more of? Will it be easier for you to free up time or to create more money? Because you do need one or the other to create the passive income stream in the first place. Then you have M, which stands for marketability. And so this is how easy is it for you to market your product? The way I like to think about this is there are thousands of services, books, courses, programs out there. What's going to make yours different? Why would somebody buy yours over the thousands that are already out there? Are you solving a problem for somebody? Do people actually need your product? So all those questions will help you determine how marketable your passive income stream is. And then the very last one is P, which stands for passivity. And this is how passive is this passive income stream. For example, owning rental property without a property manager, if you only have one or two units, it can still be pretty passive. But if you're up to 30 or 40 units without a property manager, that's not very passive. And the last thing we want to do is quit our jobs to become a full-time landlord, right? So you want to think about, okay, how can I make this more passive? Can I hire a property manager, or for a different business, how can I build this in a way where it's going to be hands off and I'm not going to end up with a full-time job that I don't want? So those are the factors of SCRIMP. That's what the acronym stands for.
Yeah. And plus, it's just awesome, too, that it's SCRIMP.
I know. Thank you.
Obviously, the opposite of what you're going for when you're trying to set up some passive income. So that worked out very well for you there. but Rachel, you know, like, so, yeah, in your book, you cover several categories of passive income using, you know, as you evaluate them with the acronym SCRIMP. And royalties from publishing, you know, like, that's one that's obviously been a route that you've taken. Can you explain why publishing, why it's an effective way to generate passive income and how you've found success with that?
Yes, absolutely. Self-publishing has been extremely lucrative for me, more so than I ever would have realized. But in a normal month now, I'm making $7,000 to $12,000 a month in passive income. And I mean, passive profit, really, from my book royalties. So there's a lot to consider when writing a book. You know, a lot of people are enamored with a traditional book deal. And I used to be enamored with a traditional book deal, but then I started asking around to other authors and doing some research, because I thought with a traditional book deal, they do all of the marketing and promotion for you. That's all the stuff I wasn't interested in. I just wanted to write a book and I wanted to start selling it. So I thought that would be a great avenue. But the more I found out, the more I realized that they still expect you to do 99% of the marketing, even with a traditional book deal. So I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to have to do all the marketing anyways, why give up my royalty? With a traditional book deal, you're going to earn a 10 to 15% royalty. But when you self-publish, you can earn 35 to 70% self-publishing on Amazon. So it can be lucrative if done the right way. And I say that because a lot of people, a lot of indie authors write a book and they write it from, I don't mean to make them sound like they're selfish, but they write it from more of a selfish standpoint. They write a book because they want to write the book and they think it's great and they enjoy writing about it, instead of looking at through the lens of, well, are people going to read this? Why would somebody care? What problem am I solving for them? So it kind of goes back to what I talked about with marketability. What unique problem are you solving? What's your unique value perspective? If you can think through those things the right way, your book will be a lot easier to sell. So I'll use Money Honey as an example. And the reason I started writing Money Honey is because I was a former financial advisor and all my family and friends came to me for financial advice, which was great. That is what I love to do. At the same time, I wondered, well, why aren't they reading books or learning on their own? And then I realized, oh yeah, that's because for most people, personal finance is boring, right? It's complex, it's intimidating, it's overwhelming. That's why I love your podcast, because it makes it so easy to understand. And so I thought to myself, well, how can I make this topic sassy and fun and simple? And that's where the idea for Money Honey came from. I wrote a book about finance that had not been written before, and that was an engaging and fun read. And they were learning a lot about money and investing in the stock market. So it really took off with female millennials, which was my target audience. And because I thought about it from that lens and that perspective, it went on to become more successful than I ever would have imagined.
That's awesome. I loved reading about why you chose to self-publish and the benefits of that. Are there any downsides? Like, let's say Penguin Random House comes to you or something like that, and they're like, we want you to publish a book now with us. Do they get your book into more of the traditional bookstores? Does that even matter anymore when you can self-publish on Amazon and the majority of books now are purchased on Amazon? I mean, yeah, how does that work out? Like, are you missing some of that? Not necessarily the marketing, right? Because you're having to get on the podcasts, on all the places to let people know that your book exists. But is placement, is that an issue?
Yes. So it is one of the downsides of self-publishing. You're not going to be able to get your book, your physical book, into physical stores. So with self-publishing, my book is sold on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, a couple other online stores, but it's not in a physical bookstore. I decided to me that didn't really matter because you're right, the vast majority of books are sold online. So I didn't feel like I was missing out from a sales perspective, or at least not a lot. And then I would say another downside is that you're going to be responsible for your own initial budget and hiring a team of people to get your book ready. Now, I don't want to scare anybody off, because I launched Money Honey with less than $600. That's all I spent. That's like as cheap as it gets. Again, maybe too cheap, maybe too frugal. But I found a way to do it on a budget. And there's definitely at least three people that you want to hire onto your team. So you want to have a really good editor, a really good book cover designer, and a really good interior formatter. And those are all things, again, that are going to come out of your own budget. You have to find them. Whereas if you get a traditional book deal, they're going to assemble that team and they're going to take care of all those things for you.
Nice. Yeah, it's good to know that, yeah, if someone out there is thinking about self-publishing, that those are three specific hires that you're going to need to make, and that's probably going to have a massive impact on the success of your book. Rachel, you mentioned $7,000 to $12,000 a month on your books. There's a reason why we're talking about royalties and publishing here, because for you, you've seen such great success within that this category. But when it does come to royalties, oftentimes folks, they'll also think about photography, they'll think about online courses, other downloadable content. But in your book as well, you mentioned franchising, but you mentioned it not in the traditional sense, right? And so a quote that we have here from the book is that you say, quote, "Don't open a franchise, offer one," which yes. I thought was genius. I just love the mindset behind that. And so can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. I'll use Chick-fil-A as an example because it's such a successful franchise. And I feel like every Chick-fil-A that I see open does so well. So a lot of people would approach that business model and think, okay, this is great. I'm going to create a passive income stream. I'm going to open a new business. I'm going to do it by becoming a Chick-fil-A franchisee. And that's great. People can make a lot of money, but it's not very scalable. You're part of somebody else's business rather than creating your own. Depending on how you run it, it's either not passive at all, or it could be very passive if you find a great manager, but you're kind of constrained. You're under somebody else's umbrella. So instead of doing that, why not start your own business and franchise it so that other people can open other branches of your business in their location? And if you can basically move from a consumer to a producer mindset in doing this, you will be very successful. I think one of the examples I used in my book is somebody that starts a tutoring business. This could be a high school kid or a college kid that starts a tutoring business. They eventually get enough tutoring clients that they really can't take on anymore. So at that point, why not hire a friend or hire another person who's good at whatever you're tutoring, hire them onto your team, coach them, provide them with clients, and they're paying you a cut of all of the money that they earn because you're providing them with clients and you're teaching them your business model. It's kind of like an informal way to franchise, but then you're unlimited, because you can hire as many tutors as possible under you, and there's no limit. And you can spread it outside your city, outside your state. You can go across the country. And now all of a sudden you have a franchise and you're not even having to do any of the direct tutoring work anymore.
Yeah, that's great. We actually, there's a friend of ours who did this on campus at the college that she was attending, and she kind of paired it with an app as well. But yeah, essentially what you're saying here is essentially to kind of think like an employer and less like an employee, less like someone doing the work and more like somebody who is finding the work for somebody. And yeah, when you do that, you have a lot more control. Yeah.
Yes, and a great resource that I'll recommend here is the book The Millionaire Fast Lane by MJ DeMarco, because he talks about all of this stuff, going from employee to employer, going from consumer to producer, and it really was an amazing mindset shift for me for how I wanted to approach and the world and becoming an entrepreneur.
Awesome. Yeah. Hey, one of the other types of passive income you mentioned in the book, Rachel, is coin-operated machines. And I want to hear you talk more about that. I actually had a friend who had a photo booth. She put it in this really cool record store in one of the hippest parts of town in Atlanta. And literally she had to go by once a month to put in, new photo strips and collect her hundreds and hundreds of dollars. It was a pretty sweet setup for her. So yeah, can you talk to us more about coin operated machines and how maybe that can be a form of passive income that people should consider?
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you brought this up because I feel like this is one of the more unique ones that people don't think about a lot. But the most common form of passive income from coin operated machines is vending machines. So if you can put a vending machine in an office lobby or a gym, or somewhere where there's a ton of foot traffic, then essentially you can go by once a week to restock the vending machine and collect the money. And it's a very passive income stream. And even if you don't want to do that, you can outsource that and have somebody do that for you. So what gets really cool is when you go from one vending machine to now you have 10 or 15 vending machines, you can even buy a pre-existing vending machine route from an owner who is looking to sell their business. That's probably the easiest way to do it because finding a location can be extremely difficult. Also, I always tell people to buy used vending machines rather than new vending machines just because it's a lot more cost effective. But you're looking at an overall investment of, you know, it could be $1,000 or a couple $1,000s to get your first vending machine, and then you can build it up from there. It's really not a lot of money that you need to put up. It's not a ton of time that you need to put up. So I do think this is one of the easier passive income streams to start building.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, it sounds like the ROI on that is pretty significant compared to maybe some of these other ventures that folks might consider, especially real estate, because that's one that costs a lot of money. You've gained a lot of your wealth through real estate. And so we'll actually talk about that category of passive income right after the break.
Back from the break, we're still talking with Rachel Richards about achieving financial independence at the age of 27, which is incredibly young. And Rachel, the biggest needle mover was real estate for you. So, you know, writing those books was obviously huge, but real estate was a big portion, and I believe remains a big portion of your passive income as well. What made you decide to pick real estate as like the passive income model that you felt like worked best for you?
Yeah. So after I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, That was the first thing that turned me on to real estate investing. And at that time, I didn't know about all these other passive income streams and that other ways to create passive income even existed. So I was like, it's real estate. This is my way out of the rat race. This is what I'm doing. So that is what I focused on first and foremost. My husband and I purchased our first duplex in 2017 in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, I always want to clarify a few things because you guys already said it, but a lot of people assume that I'm a trust fund baby because I was able to scale from zero to 38 doors in 2 years. And so I always want to say I'm not a trust fund baby, and I never made six figures from a job or a career. Wow. I started off making $36,000. So when I say that I believe anyone can do this, I truly mean it. It doesn't matter how old you are or how much money you're making. You can find a way to achieve financial independence, whether it's through real estate or through something else. Now, we had a few advantages going for us. First of all, we both graduated without student loan debt. My husband is a veteran, and he used his military benefits to pay for school. So even though we weren't making some crazy amount of income, we were attempting to be frugal and save 50% of our income every month.
Nice.
So even when I was making 36 grand, I was saving half of that. I was living off something like $1,500 a month total.
Wow.
Yes. That's awesome. So it only took a few years to come up with a little chunk of money, you know, 10 or 15 grand that I could put into real estate. Another thing we had going for us is that we invested in Louisville, Kentucky, which is a great place to invest. It's not a high cost of living area. Prices are reasonable. And the very first duplex that we found cost only $100,000. So we, by then, were able to put together a 20% down payment. We each put 10 grand in of our own money to get to our down payment. And that is how we purchased our very first duplex.
Gotcha. Well, one of the other things you talk about in your book too, when you first started out, like you were planning, or it seemed like you were planning to buy one house per year with a 15-year mortgage for a number of years. So what was the idea behind that strategy? And then it seemed like you kind of pivoted away from that strategy. Can you explain kind of why it is that you did that?
Yeah, so I don't know where I read about this strategy, but the strategy was to buy a single family house, one per year for 15 years, all on 15-year mortgages. And that way, after 15 years, you would be able to retire and quit your job because then you have the mortgages that are starting to get paid off. And so your cash flow just exponentially increases. So at the time, I was in my early 20s. I was like, this is a solid plan. I'll be able to retire in my mid-30s. Like, that would be amazing. I didn't change it intentionally. It's just that once we started investing, we realized we could achieve this a lot faster. So we became, especially after getting that first duplex, because that's always the scariest one. Once we saw that it was a reality and how much money we were already making, it was almost like we doubled down. We were like, okay, let's come up with the next down payment. Let's search aggressively. Let's see how fast we can make this happen.
And my timeline is currently too slow. Got to accelerate.
Yes. Yeah. We were so eager. And so to our shock and surprise, we were able to get to $10,000 a month in passive profit from our rentals within 2 years.
Wow. So Rachel, what do you think sets you apart maybe from other real estate investors? Like when you were starting out, obviously it wasn't the income. It wasn't making just ridiculous amounts of money and then, you know, living semi-frugally and tossing the rest towards down payments. But there are a whole lot of investors who move a whole lot more slowly than you did. You know, part of what you said was where you lived. But in speeding up that process and acquiring more properties and increasing that cash flow, like what do you think made you different than and made your experience as a real estate investor different than what a whole lot of other folks experience?
I would say two things. Number one is I'm an individual who's able to take action quickly, and I have not always been that way. I procrastinated for years, I feel like, to start investing in real estate because I had all these limiting beliefs. I was telling myself things like, you need more money, you don't have enough knowledge, you don't have enough experience, like who do you think you are, what do you think you're doing? And I waited and I waited, even though if I knew then what I know now, I could have gotten started sooner. But it's a very scary thing. But I remember thinking to myself, my fear was that I was gonna make a costly mistake, I was gonna do something that cost me money or something where I wasted my time, and I had those fears and I didn't wanna do that. Then I had to accept the fact that no matter how prepared I was or how long I waited for things to be perfect or just right, I was still going to make mistakes. Because there are things you just don't know starting out as a real estate investor. You don't know to ask them, you don't know to look for them, and you're not going to know until you go through it yourself, no matter how much prep work you do. So once I was able to accept the fact that I was going to make mistakes, I finally got over that hurdle and purchased my first investment property. And this is coming from a like type A control freak perfectionist. So this was definitely hard for me to do. But I love to share this quote by Zig Ziglar. He said, you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to be great.
Ooh,
so I love that one.
I'm going to write that down.
I'm going to get it tattooed on my left bicep probably.
Right.
Put it on your calf for everyone to see it.
There you
go. No one wants to look at your arm. Rachel, you know, like based on your book, it sounds like that you aren't buying any more properties at this point. How?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a lot of that has to do with just where you are financially. But like how does an investor know when they have enough? Like how did you arrive at that point? And what advice would you give folks who might be in a similar position?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. A lot of people, they're surprised often. You know, why aren't you continuing to build out this real estate empire? Isn't that what you want? And that has never been what we want. We've never been so passionate about it that we want to have this huge empire. We're passionate about what it allows us to do. So for us, real estate investing has always been a means to an end. Our goal was always to get to 10 grand a month in passive income from it so that we could quit our jobs and become financially independent. Once we got to 10,000, we were done. We stopped acquiring properties in 2018, and we haven't acquired any since then. And I'm glad that we were able to stick to that, because I think when you start building this empire or start as an entrepreneur, there's always this sense of, I want more, you know, what's next? I want to make this bigger. I want more money. I want more properties. But we were able to-
I want a Gulfstream.
Yes, we were able to stick to our initial goal and stop. And because of that, we've been able to enjoy the exact kind of lifestyle that we always wanted. So that's how we were able to stop, I guess.
No, that's cool. That's something that we talk about a lot on the show, and we've talked about with other guests too, is that moving the goalposts, it's a reality for so many of us when you know, as we start to do better with our money or increase our income, increase our passive income, the goalposts suddenly start moving and we're like, now this isn't good enough for me, this car, this house, whatever it may be, and we want more. And if we had just kind of, you know, been able to gauge when enough was in our lives, we would have been able to kind of stop and enjoy the lifestyle that we were like attempting to provide ourselves along the way. And I want to know too, Rachel, because you did retire early and you're traveling around the country, staying in Airbnbs right now. I know most of our listeners would say, oh, retiring in your late 20s or early 30s, whatever, that sounds perfect. But are there any downsides, would you say, to retiring so young now that you've kind of had that experience too? Are there any negatives associated with that?
Oh, for sure. There's two downsides, one of which did not impact me and one of which has. So one that impacts a lot of people when they are striving for early retirement is that they're so focused on escaping something, escaping a horrible employer, or getting out of the rat race, never working a corporate job again, getting away from that cubicle. They're so focused on the getting away from something that they don't think through what they're going towards. So if you retire, what are you going to do? Because if you're 27 or 25 or 30, you have a lot of lifetime ahead of you. The last thing you want to do is get the retirement blues, where you're basically bored during retirement. You don't have anything that fulfills you anymore. You don't have a sense of purpose. A lot of people can deal with boredom and even depression when they retire early, and they don't have a plan of how they're going to spend their time, because it can be a drastic change. So that's something I always encourage people to do, is envision what your lifestyle is going to be like. Don't just focus on, I have to quit my job. Focus on, what do you want to do in your time? What's going to be fulfilling to you? So that's one thing that can be a downside. The other thing, and this has impacted me and it still does, is that it can be lonely, right? So there's not a lot of young, self-made entrepreneurs or financially independent people. There's just not a lot of them. So finding people you can connect with or spend your time with can be challenging. It's not like I can just call a lot of my friends and be like, hey, do you want to go on a hike with me on Thursday, or climb this 14er with me on Thursday? And they're like,
they're
what
like,
do you
Rachel,
mean?
Don't rub it in. I'm working. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like now most of my friends are people that I meet in the online communities and masterminds I'm in, where these are people that relate to me in a way because they're going through similar struggles as an entrepreneur or a financially independent person. And so sometimes I feel like I have more online friends than in real life friends. So this is a struggle. I'm definitely getting more connected and meeting more people, but it's something that I feel like a lot of early retirees could run into.
Yeah, that's so true. Especially when what you do and how you are able to make a living isn't location dependent. And so, and kind of on that note, right, talking about first world problems that Rachel's dealing with, like earlier this year, you sold half of your stuff and you and your husband, your dog, you embarked on this 8-month adventure around the US. When I hear that, like, that sounds like the dream. Like I have visions of, you know, being able to kind of go on these extended road trips with my family, maybe renting an RV or something like that. But right now, I feel like you're right in the middle of that adventure. Have you run into any challenges along your travels?
Oh, for sure. And it is a dream. I mean, it's very fun. It's very cool. We're on the Oregon coast right now. And we got to see our dog see the ocean for the first time, which was so cute.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes. But the two biggest adjustments have been, number one, we're both still working remote. So we didn't retire or quit things just to like travel or be on the beach. Although some people do, and that's great. I just get bored easily. So I'm still working on my business. It's just that I now work when and if I want, and not because I have to work. So it's been a struggle because we're trying to set up our workspaces in really small Airbnbs. And I sometimes can be very uncomfortable. I'm sitting on like a step stool right now, and my laptop is on top of my suitcase. So it's not as glamorous as you would think. And then I think the other struggle has been maintaining a consistent nutrition and fitness schedule, because we're both really into that. We did sign up for Anytime Fitness because they have gyms like in every city. So we've been using those, and that's been great. But sometimes the kitchen is super small, or the fridge is not full size, so we can't meal prep or bulk cook our food like we like to do. So it can be more of a challenge to eat as healthy as we would like.
Well, Rachel, this has been an awesome conversation. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners will have learned a lot too, just getting to hear from you. So yeah, we really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Where can they find out more about you and what you're up to?
Well, thank you. And thank you guys so much for having me again. It was so fun talking to you. I would love to give your listeners my passive income starter kit for free, if that would be of interest. So anyone can go to moneyhoneyrachel.com/bonus to download that.
Awesome. Sweet. Very cool. We'll put that in the show notes too. So Rachel, thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Joel, what an awesome and insightful conversation we just had here with Rachel Richards. You know, she achieved financial independence at the age of 27, which is, I mean, oftentimes you hear folks refer to 30 as sort of like this benchmark. Like, okay, you are crazy young if you are able to reach financial independence by the time you're 30.
And you are.
And yes, you are. But 27, man, she's like, I mean, virtually set a new record for folks out there. Not that it's a race or anything like that, but it was really helpful, I think, to hear, get a peek behind the scenes and to hear some of the different strategies that she took. Obviously, real estate, that was a big part of her story, as well as self-publishing her own books. But what were your big takeaways on some of the things that we talked about today?
So really a lot of stuff. But I think one of the things that stuck out to me when we were chatting was she said, fear can paralyze you or motivate you.
Oh, as far as like how she got so far so fast, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of the things she said at the beginning, but then she kind of followed up on it too towards the end of the conversation.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. And that's when I heard it.
So yeah, I love that because basically like, and it was funny because she kind of beat herself up for not taking action quickly enough. And I'm like, you still retired at 27. Yeah. So you took action pretty quickly, but I totally understand that because we've all been in that place, right? Where we haven't attempted something that we knew would be good for our lives or that we really, we felt prepared for and we've just like been too hesitant to jump.
Sure.
And I think there is such a thing as taking blind action, right? You don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Like you want to do your research and you want to have learned something, but you also don't need to read 150 books in order to be prepared.
Right.
And so I think sometimes maybe we set that hurdle, that bar too high for ourselves and we say, no, I'm gonna gather some more information first. And information gathering is an important step, but overcoming some of those fears and doubts that are holding you back, that are causing you to turn to get more information and never take action, that's one of the things that needs to be grappled with in order to actually achieve some form of passive income.
Yep.
So I was glad she talked kind of about that mental side of it too, because it's something that you faced, it's something that I faced in this process
right.
of attempting to buy rental property. I mean, we're all kind of figuring it out and we're trying to listen to wise people, smart people who have done good things with their money too. But it's really easy to continue to sit on the sidelines thinking that you're not ready when really the only way to get ready is to like get in the game.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's great advice, especially for somebody who might be more of like a type A personality, right? Or like someone who's more of a perfectionist. And I feel like I tend to fall in that camp where I want everything to be lined up. I want everything to be perfect. Whereas I feel like you're a little more comfortable with, you know, getting the information you need and then just going for it.
Which means sometimes I can shoot from the hip.
That's right. And sometimes you're going to make mistakes, but regardless, you are going to make mistakes. And that's one of the things she followed that up with was that no matter what, you're still going to make some mistakes, but just don't let the fear of making those mistakes keep you from action.
Yeah.
So I'm 100% with you, man. I thought that was some great advice that she had. And something, I mean, and one of the things I wanted to highlight was the fact she talked about how she never made six figures before they got their first property. And so I love that little piece of information because I think a lot of folks might hear a success story like this and think, oh, well, yeah, I don't have a trust fund. I don't have this incredibly high-paying job. I'm never going to be able to achieve most of what she talked about. But that's not necessarily true because that's the kind of position that Rachel is in. She was never making a ton of money, but now she is.
Yeah, and
they got that ball rolling, like you said.
She was making $36,000 a year, living on $18,000 a year. It reminds me of my first job.
All about savings rate, man.
My first full-time job was like, I was part-time for a little bit, and then I got the first full-time gig. I was making $24,000 a year, and I was still saving money.
Yeah.
And so
it's possible.
It is possible. And you know, I would prefer not to go back to those days of living on that little money, but it is possible. And for a time, in order to achieve a greater goal, sometimes it's necessary. So yeah, I think it was good to get a little peek behind the window and realize you don't have to have mega high salaries or parents with lots of money who are willing to give it to you in order to begin that process of getting passive income in your life. Matt, what were your thoughts on the beer that we had today? This one was Old Nation Brewing M43 IPA with tart strawberry.
Yeah, this is a part of their New Orthodox series of IPAs. And I have enjoyed their M43, which is like their standard hazy IPA, many times, but I've never had this variation, this one with tart strawberries, like you said. And I will say, the first thing I noticed is right when we poured this beer, you could 100% smell the strawberries. I thought, you know, maybe it was going to be more of a subtle flavor with the strawberries in there. But I would say this is very strawberry forward. Like, there's no doubt that there are strawberries in this IPA, though it doesn't look like there's a lot of strawberry in this beer. A lot of times, strawberry beers are either dark red or pink. You can tell that there are strawberries in this. This looks like a normal IPA, but yeah, the flavor is 100% there. And interestingly, because of the sort of bitterness that you get from the hops, I feel like the way that it interacted with the strawberries, I mean, they call it a tart strawberry, and that's, I think, the right way to label this beer. Like, it almost feels like a strawberry that's not quite ripe.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, maybe it's that strawberry that's got a little bit of green at the top still, or maybe a lot of the green, but it's got a nice amount of pucker going alongside with a typical IPA flavors. Yeah, what are your thoughts on this one?
Man, I loved it. I feel like this is kind of one of my favorite beers of the moment right now.
Oh, nice.
And I really like this brewery too. Like you said, we've had the regular M43.
Yeah, they have Nation. They're so good.
Another IPA called Boss Tweed, I think is what it is, right?
Yeah, Boss Tweed, one of the best.
It really is. It's so good.
It's one of my favorites.
And so this one, to me, it brings this different combination of flavors than any other beer I've had, I feel like. And that's hard to come by now that we've had so many different craft beers. And so I love kind of the tart berry alongside this delicious IPA. It fuses together nicely, and it's just something that, especially during the summer, I'm probably going to have more of these beers in my fridge. So yeah, really dug this one. But all right, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks that want the show notes, including a link to Rachel's passive income starter kit that you can get for free, we'll put that in our show notes at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, that's right. So that's going to be it for this episode, Joel. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.